Welcome to the Right On podcast, Human Rights Activists Respond to COVID-19. I'm Meg Davis, and thank you to Calaboose for the music. I live in Geneva, Switzerland, and after 2 months of lockdown, new cases of COVID have thankfully dropped. When the sun came out last weekend, everyone was in the parks, swimming in the lake, which you can do here because the water is so clean. And the police were out too, strolling around, keeping an eye on things. It is such a different world from the one I grew up in Jamaica, Queens, in New York. When my family moved to Jamaica in the 1960s, it was a pleasant working-class neighborhood. But in the 1980s, New York was hit by an economic recession that changed everything. Many of the other white families fled to the suburbs. We didn't. We stayed. Crack cocaine came in. Gang violence grew. By the time I was a teenager, I could often hear gunfire from my bedroom window at night. And the police in Jamaica were notorious. One of my friends, who is African American, lost her brother. He was a teenage boy, waiting for the bus one night, approached by the police, a case of mistaken identity. He got scared and ran, and the cops shot him in the back and killed him. It was a tragedy, but it was all too common in that neighborhood at that time. 30 years later, global inequality has widened. The U.S. continues to struggle with police brutality, as we're seeing most recently with the tragic killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. I wanted to start by sharing this because inequality and police abuse are certainly part of the history of the United States, but also of many other countries. And to bring it all back to the pandemic, we now probably have more police on the streets today than we have globally at any time since World War II. They're enforcing lockdowns, and in some countries, enforcing brand new laws that criminalize exposure to the virus. And they're doing this in contexts of existing inequality. Tensions are high, panic is high, mistrust of the government is high. So what happens when police have to enforce these new laws in contexts of existing inequality? To discuss these issues, once again, I called up three amazing human rights activists on Zoom from the UK, Namibia, and Russia, and I asked them, can we, should we, try to police our way out of the pandemic? And we hadn't seen each other for a while.
Oh my goodness! Hey, I love your beard.
What? Oh, this old thing that I've been growing in a pandemic, really?
Yeah, it looks lovely.
Thank you very much.
All right. Edwin J. Bernard, Executive Director of HIV Justice Network. Welcome.
Thanks, Meg. It's great to be here.
And we're also joined by Felicita Hikoam, Director of ARASA, the AIDS and Rights Alliance for Southern Africa. Welcome, Felicita.
Hi, Meg, and hi, everyone.
And last but not least, Misha Golichenko, who's a Russian lawyer. Thanks for joining us, Misha.
Hi, Meg. Hi, everyone. Happy to be here.
So why don't we start with the big picture? Should police be arresting people for things like not wearing masks, or for intentionally coughing on or spitting on people if they have COVID-19. Edwin, what do you say?
Well, policing really requires the common consent of the public as opposed to the power of the state. And, you know, what is the point of the criminal law? It's to set standards for reasonable behavior. The thing is, what's reasonable when you're poor or marginalized or criminalized? But really sending people to prison for such petty crimes, including not being able to pay what some people might call reasonable fines, is only going to lead to the further spread of COVID-19. And my experience monitoring HIV criminalization shows that we've had quite a lot of cases around HIV-related spitting and biting. And we're seeing right now, we're monitoring COVID criminalization cases, and we're seeing spitting, but primarily coughing cases, where COVID is used, I guess, primarily by people who are mentally ill or marginalized people in order to scare the police. But of course, unlike with HIV, which cannot be transmitted by spitting, COVID can. But then why aren't police using universal precautions or being given PPE? since we're all supposed to treat everyone as if they're infectious. What's really interesting for my organization, we've been working against HIV chromization for a long time, is that monitoring what's been going on with policing and COVID is that we're seeing the police are much more afraid now of COVID than they are of HIV. And I saw last week for the first time a woman who claimed to have both HIV and COVID who spat at a policeman while she was being arrested. The fear, both in the media report and also in terms of the court, was only about COVID, which is a complete reversal of how it's always been for HIV criminalization. And she pleaded guilty to 2 counts of assaulting a police officer, and has been remanded in prison until her sentencing at the end of May. So the thing is, HIV criminalization is still an issue during COVID-19, and we're seeing new cases all the time. It's been said by many people before, I'm going to say it, but you can't police your way out of a pandemic, whether it's HIV or COVID, and over-relying on policing, I think, is a smokescreen for a lack of political leadership, a lack of public health preparedness, and in some cases, like in Hungary, an opportunistic power grab.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I imagine it's fairly hard to prove definitively that one person transmitted a virus to another person, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the reality, of course, with HIV criminalization, many laws actually are around non-disclosure or potential or perceived exposure rather than actually transmission. With COVID, I'm not sure we're seeing laws or prosecutions specifically around transmission. It's about fear. It's about fear of potential or perceived exposure. Basically, you can prosecute people for creating fear. You can prosecute people for assault. As with HIV, policing COVID is basically seen along the same fault lines. It's always the marginalized, the already criminalized, the poor, the people with mental health issues. So even when you have the idea of the police who need to do something to ensure that public health measures are respected, the people who really are feeling the long arm of the law are the same people who are impacted by the HIV pandemic and the TB pandemic and hepatitis. It's the people who are always marginalized.
Right. Felicita, what are you seeing in Southern Africa? Is it very much this kind of targeting of people who are marginalized?
Absolutely. I have to agree with Edwin that it does actually target the most marginalized and vulnerable populations of society. And we've seen several examples in Southern and East Africa where this has been the case, where in order to enforce regulations that have been put in place due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and many states have now declared states of emergency or states of disaster, and that has come along with severe limitations in movements and also in terms of, you know, the freedom and the right to association, etc. And this is required for the police force to be allowed to regulate and enforce the regulations that have now been put in place. And in some cases, actually, as in my own country, Namibia, the defense force has also been engaged in policing, and there has been a lot of criticism against this because the defense force is not trained for policing, but this has now been the case. It is similar in South Africa, and you can often get to a roadblock and see defense force members with AK-47s or with weapons that are quite scary. But also the fact that the enforcement of these regulations has really been arbitrary due to the kind of vague nature of the regulations, the broad scope of the regulations, the dependence on the discretion of the law enforcement official in whatever situation they find themselves, as well as kind of a lack of engagement of communities when these regulations were put in place. And that there are also not clear guidelines provided for law enforcement in terms of, you know, when they are supposed to use their discretion, how can they actually rely on being provided with clear guidelines that support them in making decisions when they find themselves in those situations. But what we've seen in this region is that a lot of the enforcement and the police abuse has been targeted at poor people. So vendors, for example, people who are hawkers, people who are selling goods on the streets, people who are homeless. We've seen a lot of cases reported in South Africa in particular around people who use drugs, who happen to be homeless as well. And then there have been cases also recently reported against sex workers who have been specifically targeted by the police in hotspots that where they're known to be working. And also we've had a lot of targeting of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people. And I've actually recently heard about an incident about a transgender member of the community who actually presented to a police station to request a permit. So in Namibia and South Africa, under the highest level of restrictions of movement and lockdown, we have had to request permits. Even as an essential services worker, you need to have a permit on you to be able to travel. And even if you wanted to travel for medical reasons from one town to another town, you needed to go to the police station and request for a permit to travel. And a transgender woman actually presented to the police station and requested one of these permits and was firstly harassed, was ridiculed, and was then denied this permit because the police, for whatever reason, didn't see it fit to provide a permit for this person to travel. So even in terms of the discrimination and applying for these permits, there has been a targeting of vulnerable and marginalized communities. So we've seen quite a lot of it.
Interesting. And I would imagine it's not easy for a lot of people to apply for and get permits, right?
Absolutely. And you have to have the time to actually spend in queues because we've had a lot of people needing these permits, and especially closer to the weekends when people are traveling for whatever reason, whether it's a funeral. I mean, we can now have people gather in groups of 10. So whether it's for a funeral, whether it's for whatever reason, I've heard of cases where people have actually spent 3-4 hours at a police station waiting for one station commander to sign off on these permits.
Misha, I see you nodding, so I'm guessing that you're seeing some similar kinds of issues in Russia as well.
Yeah, well, first talking about marginalized groups, people from the community of people who use drugs, especially people with drug dependence, these are people worse affected. People who live on the streets, homeless people, Russia does not provide any good, reasonable help to them. And of course, they are even more marginalized now. And migrants. There are several interviews with police officers and statements from police officers who openly saying that migrants often don't really understand what this all restrictions are about. They don't understand the epidemic. And I can imagine what kind of issues migrants are facing. I know that some groups of migrants living in their apartments, and sometimes it's really crowded places. They try to save money, live together. And if one is sick, everyone is sick. And well, they have to somehow find the way to get money and earn money. And some of them would have a very limited ability to speak the language. And all the array of issues you can just imagine. So that's the marginalized groups who are mostly marginalized with this time. Prisoners, that's another group. Even the Human Rights Council attached to the presidential administration advised prison authorities and courts not to put people in jail and release those who were committed nonviolent crimes. Nothing of this fulfilled. There were some very timid recommendations from the Supreme Court not to put people in pretrial detention, but not many regions are really following that. No prison, no region in Russia, no province in Russia really undertook any measure to release prisoners from prison. So prisons are still kept in the same way as if nothing happened. And we know that there were several riots in some of Russia's provinces. And instead of responding appropriately to this, by way of releasing prisoners, Russian authorities just put more restrictions on information, on the access of lawyers to prisons. It's this all usual way to restrict information, restrict human rights defenders instead of reacting appropriately. And unfortunately, the first critical time, I'd say end of February, where Russia could have responded way better than it did, Russian media outlets and the federal TV channels, they all promoted the message that the epidemic doesn't exist. It's all in China. It's not going to affect Russia. So it was a kind of critical setup of culture of denialism.
And this then sounds very familiar from the United States, I have to say.
Exactly. And then by the time when the epidemic came to Russia and authorities in such places as Moscow actually decided to impose restrictions, this culture was already among population. So now police is the first line responder to something which was actually created by the state. So police is trying to herd people who don't really understand what is epidemic about firsthand, but then based on this misunderstanding, there was the news that there's no epidemic. And then all of a sudden, yes, there is epidemic and you have to sit at home. But worst of all, Russian authorities do not really help financially to people. There's no something like the financial help we see in the US or in Canada or in many European countries. So people are left alone with all this problem. People have to think how to earn money. They are restricted. They have to sit at home. And as I said, people don't really believe in epidemic. Many people face police when police are trying to say them, you should stay at home. They start arguing. And unfortunately, despite all the enormous police powers in Russia, arguing with police is a kind of national sport. So you can imagine now what type of situation Russia is facing now, right?
You know, it's really interesting because it just mimics in this like totally different scale what we saw with HIV, right? Which was initial denialism, failure to invest in health systems, and then falling back on criminal laws and policing in order to really target the most marginalized and most vulnerable people who are actually the ones we need to be putting first. Why do we just keep doing the same thing over and over again?
You're asking us?
Yeah. I mean, you're all smart people.
Well, I think all of us are trying to make sure that the mistakes aren't made again. But the reality is that we're still dealing with all of the problems of HIV and with criminalization and TB to a lesser extent and hepatitis in some places. So, you know, then overlay a new pandemic. And it really just unearths all of the problems that we've had dealing with, particularly with HIV, and exacerbates them. So, of course, the criminal justice system and policymakers and parliamentarians who are in power now weren't around 30 or 40 years ago, didn't have that power, and they don't seem to want to listen to us. And it feels like we're often Cassandras, we're treated like Cassandras. What Misha was saying about denial, I was thinking about how, because I've been living with HIV since the early 80s, and thinking about how I'm, I hate to use the word triggered, but how I'm triggered by what's going on with COVID. And I was telling my mother that actually I'm living now in a state of functional denial. I think like the whole world's living in a state of functional denial, like I used to, at least for the first 15 years of my own HIV diagnosis until I was on effective treatment. And on, you know, on one level you think, well, I could be dead in a month, which is how I used to think and how it's possible to happen to us now if we're unlucky with the way COVID impacts us. Or at the same time, we have to hope for the best. We have to fight for the rights of ourselves, for our communities, for the marginalized. We have to keep hope alive and keep doing the work that we're doing. But at the same time, it's a weird, I don't want to say a rude word, it messes with the mind.
Oh, you can actually. We have a word for explicit content.
Meg, it's a mind fuck. The whole thing is a mind fuck.
I knew it.
Yeah, I got explicit clearing for this podcast because I figured.
Wow, okay.
I actually wanted to add on to some of the thoughts around like how we keep repeating the mistakes and that saying that says, you know, a lesson will be repeated until it's learned. And I think one of the things that we're also doing wrong with this COVID response that we should have learned from the HIV response is around the engagement of communities, right?
Absolutely.
Also in terms of ensuring that the response itself is grounded in human rights principles. Particularly, I'm reflecting on some of the issues in our region because of the political history in our region and a lot of repression and a kind of a violent political past, there is a lot of mistrust in government, right? And that also challenges people's
ability to comply with some of these regulations. I think there's the real kind of, you know, real circumstances within which people find themselves that limit their ability to actually follow the regulations. But there is also a real issue around trusting the intentions of government. One of the things that I've heard about, you know, how South Africa is getting it right in terms of the leadership that they're showing and the leadership that the president is showing is because he comes from a place of empathy and he's almost apologizing to people every time he appears to say, you know, I know this is really difficult, but we have to do this together and this is for our own good, etc. But I don't see many other governments approaching it that way.
I'll say
it's very authoritative. Yeah. It's very authoritative and it's very paternal in a way. And it doesn't bode well with inspiring confidence and trust as well. And also our own case, and I'm going to be quite critical of our response so far, is that even though Namibia has only had 16 cases for the last 4 weeks or so, I think one of the things we've learned from kind of HIV criminalization is that changes need to happen as evidence and science changes, right? And should be based on evidence and scientific proof. And what we're not seeing in some of the way that these regulations are being imposed or policed is the kind of scientific reasoning as to why these regulations are necessary in the first place. And I think apart from people not having trust, it's also, it doesn't bode well when you actually don't have scientific evidence for backing up the kinds of policing and the kinds of restrictions that you are putting in place. And I think those are some of the things that we really are not doing well in terms of learning from the HIV response.
Yeah, beautifully said. And I think you've said a lot of rich stuff, but I just want to come back to this point about community engagement, because that's so much at the core of the global HIV response now. Wasn't in the beginning, but I think because of the leadership of people living with HIV and families and friends and allies, we've developed a response that is really emphasized and continues to fight to ensure that the people who are most affected by HIV, so people living with HIV, obviously sex workers, people who use drugs, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans people, are at the center of consultations and policy making and deciding how funds are mobilized and spent, accountability, and all the rest of it. So if we think about this from the perspective of COVID-19, what would that look like? Are we thinking about like going out and mobilizing the elderly, or like what, you know, what does community engagement look like for COVID? We're getting a little off topic, but I think it's relevant as well.
I'm just going to jump in there. I think one of the things that's also necessary and that I haven't seen happening is also consultations around the construct of families and communities and societies that we find ourselves in. So for example, requiring people to practice social distancing and for people to stock up in terms of food supplies, et cetera, at a time, is very impractical for some poor, you know, households and communities that don't have the kinds of resources that other communities may have, where they are able to actually go out and, you know, have a whole trolley full of food that can keep them going for 2 weeks. I know communities in this region where people have to literally, somebody, you know, in the morning, it's like, oh, go and buy a loaf of bread. Oh, and then, you know, we'll look at, you know, do we have enough money for sugar? And then somebody else has got to go to the store. So it's very impractical in terms of, you know, having this kind of blanket approach to the regulations that don't take into account in the socioeconomic construct of what communities and societies look like.
The realities of what people...
The realities.
The actual lives.
Exactly. And maybe, I mean, just consulting with community-based groups that actually have an understanding of how these things function might have been helpful. They might have actually been able to say, listen, let's have, you know, different types of regulations for different contexts. And let's, you know, give information to communities and to people about how they can adapt their lives to comply with these regulations.
I haven't heard of any place that's really doing that. Maybe New Zealand? I don't know. Not Russia, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, short answer is, of course, not Russia. Imposing restrictions on large cities in the way Moscow does might be a good example to follow, right? There are certain problems, but Moscow is doing rather well. But replicating the similar set of restrictions in some places where population does not exceed 20,000 and there are not many high-rise buildings, and imposing the same level of severe restrictions on that places without actually explaining or listening to the public And unfortunately, since 2004, in Russia, municipalities gradually lost all powers to do something meaningful on its municipal level. And that's a problem. And answering to your question, Meg, what can we do to bring back the voice of communities? I guess the municipalities, the level of municipal government and power entrusted to municipalities is what really matters now. I've heard this long mantra of cities gonna run this world, but I think in this time, in times of COVID, this mantra shines with its new light, because that's exactly what should have been done on the level of municipalities. Municipalities should understand its population, should be given enough power to talk to people and accommodate their wishes and explain what's really going on. And just the last bit from me on this particular point. Unfortunately, what this epidemic also showed is the lack of voice of professionals, such as medical professionals. Again, in Russia, it's never been that strong as it should be, but for the last 15 years, medical unions have been disbanded. If they ever existed, even in a very low-level format, they're now disbanded. There are just a couple of professional unions there, which are trying to speak on behalf of doctors, trying to complain of the mismanagement, trying to complain of the lack of protecting measures set up in clinics. Those people are actually threatened with prosecution by police for allegedly spreading the fake news about the epidemic as soon as doctors started complaining and saying that we have way more cases of death of coronavirus or incidents because they see what's going on and state is prosecuting them instead of helping.
Edwin, do you want to come in on this point?
Yeah, I was just thinking about just meditating on this concept of communities. And I think one of the things that is different though from the HIV response is we know the key populations are those who are most impacted both by the virus and also tend to be the most marginalized. I think it's quite different with COVID. So the people who are most at risk of COVID, as you mentioned, tend to be the elderly or people with underlying health conditions, although people with HIV who have access to treatment who have an undetectable viral load are meant to have no different outcome. But and then when you think about the stigma of COVID, the stigma of COVID is all about fear of contagion around COVID. It tends to be healthcare workers have been stigmatized because of the fear of contagion. People who are either of Chinese descent or are thought to be of Chinese descent are being stigmatized. But the people who are being most impacted by the state's response, which is this punitive, criminalized response, are in fact the same people who are the key populations in the HIV pandemic, those who are already marginalized and criminalized. Communities, there's so many different communities to talk to. I mean, it's very clear that it's the economic inequalities that is really having a much bigger impact. And of course, there are social determinants of health. So we've got to equalize those inequalities as well. Obviously, those are far more effective than punishment and imprisonment. But the default seems to be to move to policing this pandemic. So, but we're still in the very early stages. We're only a few months in. Of course, we need to learn these lessons, but we're still in this early panic mode. And I think, just as you mentioned at the beginning, around how before there was a public health response to HIV, there was a criminal law response. You know, HIV criminalization was invented by the US in the mid-80s, and laws were passed way before there was ever really a galvanized public health response. And so hopefully we can learn those lessons, even though it is early days. And conversations like these will hopefully lead to more conversations, be heard by people who actually have power to actually make the changes.
Yeah, I think you're making really good points about the stigma and how criminalization actually increases stigma. I just wanted to just flip this around for a moment. And Bikalista, you mentioned the defense forces being brought out and mobilized. And here in Switzerland, we've had, I mean, we're now about to come out of lockdown, so we'll see how that goes. But we've had more police and National Guards on the streets than at any time since World War II, apparently, including a lot of people who were not trained police officers, right? So there are people who were civilians who were then maybe kind of being kept on ice for a while and were brought back out on the streets to help enforce lockdown. And provide support. I mean, they also did things like bringing food to people who are elderly and assisting people. So it wasn't all enforcement. So I'm just trying to imagine the challenges that police and other forces must be facing right now. And I'm looking at Misha because I believe he's the only one among us who's actually worked in the police. So maybe you can shed some insight, Misha.
Right. I actually thought about this a lot. Every time when I see news that police beaten somebody on the street for violating the restrictions, I can't imagine what kind of situations police now are facing. As I said, when the population, the majority, either openly don't believe or they just so angry because nobody is helping financially, they have to do something. And they are just, instead of given any viable alternatives to the severe restrictions, they are just said that you have to stay home, otherwise you'll face the fines. So people are angry, and police, unfortunately, and that's the very much a feature of Russian police, that police isn't really trained of how to do a proper community policing, how to explain the population, how to apply the conflict resolution tools, how to mitigate certain conflicts, which are very much growing from the population's frustration. So police is there to impose fines or to act with the might of police authority, but there's no any other tools given to police to mitigate the situation. And those all cases, even outside of the COVID, even before the COVID, when we see that police beaten somebody or even inflicted deadly wounds on a person somewhere on the street, they all stem from this inability, which during the epidemic, when police is given enormous power on the one hand, and the population set up in the mode of denialism, and that's a real problem. And another thing is it's part of policing as well. The usual Russia's response to issues related to large number of people who supposed to be guided, managed, over-reliance on policing is somewhere in the culture of Russian administration. And this over-reliance is so obvious now when any problem, which we can imagine during the epidemic, say, for example, the spike in cases, the first line response is that police is there, police is trying to investigate, police initiate the criminal prosecution. And that's just a great example of how badly Russian authority is responding. Many people from police force report that they are not given masks or gloves. Some forces respond to journalists that one mask and one set of gloves is for them for a week, you can imagine. They unfortunately have to work in such settings as underground, subway, or public transport, where risk of infection is very high for them. Prison guards, I don't understand these people, why they do not complain. They are the first line responders to something which the state does not manage well. And I don't hear the voice of prison guards saying that we don't want to work in the environment where state is not responding well and we are on the front line exposed to a higher risk of infections. So, yeah, it's a poorly managed epidemic where police, unfortunately, is on the front line and at the higher risk than anybody else, except probably doctors.
Yeah. As we talk about this, I'm reflecting how much for the first time I'm hearing so many human rights activists talking about what are fundamentally labor rights, right? I mean, for a long time, these have been sort of separate movements. And I think finally we're seeing how completely interdependent they are. But Edwin, over to you.
Yeah, well, so I was saying earlier about the idea, why aren't police given personal protective equipment and why aren't there universal precautions for those on the front lines? And obviously that's a scandal. It's an absolute outrage in so many places, and that instead the police respond because they are human and they are fearful like the rest of us, and they're put in positions that that put them at risk, and then unfortunately put other people at risk, and then by sending people to prison puts them and the prison population at risk. But this is really what happens when the police have a lack of leadership. There aren't clear laws, there aren't clear policies, there isn't clear guidance. We've seen that with HIV criminalization. you know, HIV criminalization laws where they exist are vague and overbroad and can be applied in so many ridiculous and problematic ways, particularly unscientifically, but in ways that are just completely the opposite of the human rights approach. And of course, with COVID, we're seeing that it's a panic amongst lawmakers passing laws that they, in the UK, you know, the laws are being passed, but they're called rules. And therefore, is it a law that you're breaking? Is it a regulation? Mm-hmm. So it's really confusing, not only for the public, but for the police. And, you know, I was on a call last week, Nick Cross from the Centre for Law Enforcement and Public Health, and he obviously has a long history of seeing all the problems with policing and has worked very hard to help train police and has done incredibly good work. But at the same time, he recognizes that policing is failing in so many areas around COVID, as it has with HIV, but highlights police are human. And unless they actually are trained, as Misha said, and are given the tools, policing the pandemic is always going to be a problem, not just for those who are vulnerable and marginalized, but for the police themselves.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we're getting towards the end of our time, and I just want to make sure we have a moment to think towards the future, because my undying belief is that the human rights movement and the human rights framework offers us a way to develop a different kind of world when we come out of this thing. If we come out of this thing, maybe we just have COVID part of our environment for a long time. So I'd just like to hear from each of you what you think the human rights system offers as we think about the future.
Meg, I can start. And I share your optimism, because I think for once, what this crisis has done is to actually highlight and really shine a light on the inequalities and the inequities that exist. And I've heard for the first time people who I don't really engage and who have never heard speak on kind of addressing inequalities and underlying socioeconomic inequalities, for once actually recognize that at the end of the day, the one lesson that we're learning from this crisis is how unequal our societies are and how that inequity and that inequality that exists makes us all vulnerable. And, you know, although I do disagree with it, one thing that I had heard recently was around how the COVID-19 crisis is the great equalizer, because in an African context, they said that for once African presidents and others with influence and money won't be able to fly out of the continent to access better healthcare. Now we'll all have to suffer the consequences of the lack of investment in public health systems. And although, I mean, I know that will not be the case, that they will actually be prioritized in terms of accessing tests and accessing treatment and accessing, you know, healthcare, etc. It does actually shine a light on the fact that the lack of investment in addressing inequalities has been our biggest downfall and is actually what has made us the most vulnerable in this crisis. And I agree with you that one of the things that we're learning from the HIV response and from the human rights movement is to put people and communities first. I think it's important for us, as we watch every day the statistics and we're thinking about, oh, there's so many cases and, you know, so many deaths, etc. I think the fact that we're dealing with people and human beings sometimes gets lost. So making sure that we remember and reflect on the fact that this is actually affecting people's lives and human beings. And the fact that if we put people and communities and the diversity of people and those that are most marginalized at the forefront of our responses, that our responses will actually be effective. There's so many other things that we've learned about, you know, dealing with crises from the health movement, from HIV and from human rights. But I think central for me has been stigma is not useful. Punitive approaches are not useful, and addressing underlying inequalities has to be a priority for all of us going forward. I'll stop there, and I'll, you know, allow Edwin and Mitch to also chip in.
It's hard. It's hard to top that, Felicity. I mean, obviously, the work that we do at the HIV Justice Network and that we do collaboratively with the RASA and the HIV Legal Network and others as part of HIV Justice Worldwide is, of course, we know that communicable diseases are public health issues and not criminal issues, and that we need to ensure that human rights are respected and empower communities. All the things that you've already said, that's far more effective than punishment and imprisonment. So, of course, human rights has to be at the center of the response. And it's, for many years, there's this false dichotomy, public health or human rights. Of course, you can only achieve public health by ensuring that human rights are enjoyed by all. And right now, of course, people are pitting one right against another. And we're seeing that with in the US, for example. My right to go shopping at Target is, you know, means that, you know, you whatever, those ridiculous rights, people think that's a human right to go shopping. Obviously, there are really critical human rights.
Water skiing, though, is fundamental. I mean, that's Michigan.
Yeah. Absolutely. And getting a haircut. Yeah. Getting a
nail done. I definitely need one.
But, I mean, we haven't talked about the Syracuse principles, and perhaps they need to be discussed completely at a separate time, that gives us a lot of clues about how and when human rights can be abrogated and when they should be restored. And I think perhaps we should I would suggest another podcast, Meg, talking about the Syracuse principles to explain exactly why human rights is the answer to a public health pandemic.
All right. Well noted. Thank you. All right, Misha, the floor is yours.
Very short one. Just to add, I completely agree with what Felicity and Edwin said. And I have not been to the mountaintop, but I have a dream. And my dream is the realization for police officers, medical professionals, and those I would broadly call administrators, of how highly interdependent we are. And this interdependence is a very well understood fabric of human rights. I shall say that police should realize that human rights of those who they are mandated to police is equally their human rights. When you are trying to police people and your policing is in effect bringing them even further to the very margins of society, you're marginalizing yourself, and discrimination, stigma, criminalization is the worst response, and only the response, the last resort, which should only be applied to the very, 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 very limited scope and to the very limited number of cases, and by far cases where health is implicit shouldn't be that cases at all. So mutual responsibility for human rights of each other, Syracuse principle, I absolutely second this. It's a very great framework to keep people analyzing of what's going on around them, and professionals should be part of the wider communities, be shoulder to shoulder in this fight for human rights with police officers and doctors.
That's a beautiful vision of interdependence. I really love it. Well, I think we've certainly been all dependent on the three of you to help us understand criminalization and policing in the COVID crisis. So thank you so much, Edwin J. Bernard from HIV Justice Network, Felicita Hikuam at ARASA, and Misha Golichenko. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Meg.
The Syracuse principles were adopted by the UN Economic and Social Council in 1984. They set out when and how states can restrict human rights and state that these restrictions must be grounded in law, based on scientific evidence, and the least intrusive means available. The Right On podcast is an all-volunteer project. Thank you to Arun Kumar for help on this episode. The theme song, Thermosphere, is by Calaboose. Check them out on Bandcamp, Spotify, Apple Music, and all streaming services. Thank you for listening. Stay well, stay strong, and keep fighting the good fight.